In Your House 6, Rage in the Cage. It took place February 18th, 1996. It had an attendance of 5,500 with a buy rate of 0.74. Boy, WWF was not finding its footing at this time, was it, Matt?
That's the nice way to put it.
Yes. Oh my goodness. This was a show I didn't watch it live. I don't think I cared enough to get In Your House around this time. I think I was saving up for WrestleMania that year. I did get WrestleMania the next month, but this pay-per-view kind of went by the wayside with me and I didn't catch up to it till years later. Man, this definitely not the height of WWF creative for sure.
No, but it's also sandwiched in between their two biggest shows of the year, the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania.
Yes.
So it kind of gets lost in the shuffle almost by default.
That's a great point, Matt, because this is a show that pretty much its job is to pretty much hype up the next month's pay-per-view.
Yeah, because you're setting up your two featured guys, Shawn and Bret, are going to be in the main event. So they have the two most important matches on this show. And you got a couple of other players that are going to be on the WrestleMania card, but just trying to figure out where to slot them in. I think the writing was on the wall, though, that it was a foregone conclusion. Shawn was going to beat Bret at WrestleMania. I don't think there was any doubt even at this point. Because you can just look at the reaction Shawn gets compared to Bret. Shawn was clearly more ready to be fully accepted by the fans as the top babyface as opposed to Bret. It was still getting a good reaction, but there was a certain amount of familiarity with him as champion.
Yeah, for sure. Shawn was getting the bigger response, and I think I mentioned in shows previous that Bruce Pritchard and Pat Patterson really had to talk Vince into giving Shawn this shot. Took a while to convince him, but it was apparent at this point he had been convinced, and they're going to give him the ball and let him run with it. But there's something that's interesting about this show in that, you know, we're going to have the title shot on the line here where he's going to be facing the person who, storyline-wise, took him out for a number of months. So I thought that was kind of well done. As we talked about when we talked about the show where Shawn was pretty much beaten up by people and that's how they explained it. But yeah, they were getting on the Shawn train for sure. Speaking of people who are on the Shawn train, we open up with Sunny.
Oh, holy. Like between this and Royal Rumble where it was her in the tub.
Yes.
She was the first woman I think they were really overly sexualizing in the WWF. As early as I can remember, this is probably the first one. And this show's PG, you know, it's just her in a bikini. You know, not there's anything wrong with that, except for me, it doesn't move. But you're really starting to see that little ember that's gonna become the TNA aspect of the Attitude Era starting to make its way in.
Let me tell you, as a 19-year-old, this really did move me. I was a Sonny mark. I had a poster of Sonny. I was all about Sonny in this era, and she was all the way live, as they say, which really makes me sad when I see her in the prison jumpsuit in pictures now. It makes me sad, man, because she really was something, a big part of my teenage years, for sure. She's here to say, Matt, that viewer discretion is advised. And
yeah, especially if you watch the contents of this show.
Be sure to have something that wakes you up throughout the course of this show. Although I think it starts off okay because, you know, say what you will about the WWF, even in this era, they had some pretty good videos to hype up their matches. And I love their opening videos to these shows. And this one doesn't disappoint either, where looking at Diesel's rivalries with Hart and The Undertaker to kind of hype up this show. Pretty good intro video, I would say.
Yeah, and you're teasing what Diesel's going to be doing at WrestleMania. So yep. it's fulfilling its purpose. But I also love, as soon as they cut to the arena, clear as day, the first thing you see is a Bischoff sucks poker.
Yes.
I guarantee you that was not an accident.
Our commentators for this show are Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler. One of the underrated commentator teams. I probably say that every time we do one of these shows. But I love Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler on the mic. You know, I remember reading Jerry Lawler's autobiography from I think it was like 2002 2003. He talked about how it was fun doing these shows with Vince, and even Jesse Ventura talked about this too, where Vince would tell them to give me a hard time about my hairpiece, give me a hard time about anything you want, because it makes for good television. And this was Lawler's favorite part, was doing this stuff. Even if he wasn't a fan of having to do commentary, he wanted to be in the ring.
Yeah, well, Vince also, because he was writing the product, you know, he could be the effective storyteller. And Lawler as a heel has just always worked better. I've never cared. I'm not the biggest Lawler fan to begin with, even when he was a heel, because he just became nothing but puppies and putting over Triple H. Like, he became such a cartoon. But when you go back to this era, where he ripped on the Hart family, like saying that Stu and Helen produced more tragedies than Shakespeare, and, you know, the toupee jokes, ripping Jake the Snake for being a drunk, both in kayfabe and in real life on the DVD. He lived the king. Like, he literally said, it's good to be the king, and I'm gonna talk down to everybody, which is why I think this era he was so effective at what he did.
You know what wasn't effective in this era, Matt? The booking. Because,
well, if you were not in the clique.
This opening match has Jim Cornette written all over it. Because we have a crybaby match with Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 kid who's here with the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. You're right, two members of the clique, of course, but in a crybaby match.
So here's problem number one of a laundry list. I have my own Jim Cornette shit list of things wrong with this segment. They should have saved this for WrestleMania, when you really think about it. The big blow-off to this angle, because it's been going on for damn near 6 months. You think they would have saved the final gimmicky type of match for WrestleMania for that program, because you look at what Razor would wind up doing. This program could have been saved for that, but this gimmick of the crybaby with the bottle and the diaper, it's so... This feels like 1993 all over again, not 1996, where things were starting to get a little bit more progressive, and it feels like a relic of a bygone era that does not play, even at the time.
I would go earlier than that. This feels 80s Mid-South to me, you know, which is why I say Cornette has his fingerprints all over this. This has to be an idea of his. But don't forget, too, Razor Ramon was also in the midst of a program with Goldust, and that blow-off was supposed to happen the next month. And we'll talk about what happened with that next week. Ramon was already on his Scott Hall was on his way out. So
was Kevin Nash.
Eventually. But it wouldn't. Kevin Nash was still in for the long haul for the longest time. And we'll talk about the breaking point. In fact, the breaking point happens on this card, which we'll talk about. So let's go ahead and just get into it. So the backstory here is, you know, Run 2-3 Kid cost Razor Ramon the Intercontinental Championship back at the Royal Rumble, and he spent a lot of the ensuing weeks labeling Razor Ramon a crybaby, and that's how we get to this match, in that the loser would have to wear a giant diaper and suck from a giant baby's bottle. Yes, I just said those words.
Yeah, this is one of those things where when you have to explain to people, no, wrestling is actually good. Because there's so many gimmick matches where, like, a kiss my ass match, this,
yeah,
where you almost feel like you have to apologize for being a wrestling fan. I know not everything can be a steel cage or a ladder match, but this is so far on the other extreme to being childish that you almost feel ashamed for liking this art form.
Your lover's like mine, right? Like, he does not like wrestling at all. I am so glad Jen did not walk in while this match was on, because she would say, what the hell is it that you grew up on? You're right. It is kind of embarrassing at times. But, you know, as silly stipulations aside, I thought this match was actually pretty entertaining. We're starting off with Razor pummeling 1-2-3 Kid from pillar to post. Yet 1-2-3 Kid, he rolls to the outside, and Ted DiBiase, he's there to come to his rescue. He temporarily blinds Razor Ramon with a handful of baby powder.
Yeah, yes, I just said that. Like what Mr. Fuji does to Brett.
Yes.
WrestleMania 9.
Yes, the ceremonial salt. And allowing the 1-2-3 Kid to jump from the top rope and drill him with a nice-looking drop kick. So then they decide to kind of take it easy a bit, killing off the middle of the match with a sleeper hold from 1-2-3 Kid to Razor Ramon. And we have a little bit of a comeback from Razor, which led to both guys just kind of taking a nap in the middle of the ring. Apparently, they're tired. Things did pick up towards the finish. Razor Ramon, he's mounting a solid comeback and hitting him with two Razor edges to wrap things up. Yet, as fun as that might have been, the mid-bout kind of put a damper on things. But Razor Ramon is your winner here. What do you think of the match?
It's good. It's deserving of a better gimmick. Because I think this could have been like the WrestleMania opener, where the loser, you just blow it off in a traditional way. I found this to be just so Childish as being kind and also kind of a play on this actual segment, but oh god, it goes to show even then that they were still, they needed that kick in the ass from Nitro to get away from this type of nonsense.
Yeah. He's the winner at 12:01, by the way. I forgot to mention the time there.
Yeah, this match went longer than anything on Clash of the Champions.
Yes, that we discussed last week. That's a great point. Yes.
By several minutes, because this one went over the 10-minute mark, which is a record.
Yep. Oh, my God. And, of course, we're having, you know, Ramon. He's wrapping up 1-2-3 Kid in this baby powder and diaper and... like you said, sometimes you just kind of look and say, what is it about this art form that I love so much? But you know what? Like you mentioned, though, not every match has to be an emotional standstill. You know, not every match has to be tons of stakes riding on it. Sometimes you just have to throw a fun one on there. But, God, this just kind of went over the edge as far as the gimmicks go.
Yeah, and these guys did the best with – they did as good of a job selling this as you could. They were consummate professionals. You know, even though it's a match between friends, so it's certainly no harm, no foul in a locker room type of sense. But, God, this is not, like, on the chart, I don't think this is one of the worst gimmick matches of all time, but at least they did this once and never did it again.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All right, so our next match, we have Hunter Hearst Helmsley taking on Duke the Dumpster Drosy.
Speaking of matches, we are extreme WrestleMania.
We are in the midst of... the occupation era, shall we say, you know, Vince putting all these guys in these different gimmicks, you know, T.L. Hopper and Duke the Dumpster. Isaac Yankum, good example. And we're having Hunter Hearst Helmsley come out with porn stars. So.
Yeah, the Connecticut Blue Blood has a fetish for American pornography. Which, that type of character, you think he would fling his nose at that, which... I mean, it's Triple H. His nose is fucking huge, so it'd be pretty easy to do.
I always loved when Vince McMahon was on commentary during Hunter Hearst Helmsley matches because he always mentioned how big his nose was during the match.
And he had a hard-on for saying Hunter Hearst Helmsley as quickly as he could.
Yes.
It's amazing that it took like almost 2 years for him to say, you know what, let's just go with Triple H.
When they were finally starting to get away from the gimmicks. But this match opens up. We have some brawling to start off. And then we go to a crawl as Hunter's just kind of methodically taking his opponent apart. Duke the Dumpster, he did get a comeback going, even hitting him with a trash compactor. Yet, rather than getting the victory, the Drosy just kind of leaves the ring for his garbage can. Referee grabs the main part of the can, distracting Duke Dumpster long enough for Triple H to grab the lid, drill him from behind, and steal the victory at 9 minutes and 38 seconds. My God, how did Hunter Hearst Helmsley end up being the powerhouse that he was doing matches like this? Not his fault, by the way, but still.
Yeah, but the problem is you're trying to build who will become Triple H into being a credible star. To a certain degree, but he's beating a guy that nobody buys.
Exactly.
So it kind of, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways.
How he withstood this without leaving and going to WCW with to join his buddies, I have no idea, but good for him.
Well, especially with what happens, you know, with the fallout of Hall and Nash leaving, I think at some point he would have said, you know, F this.
Of course, yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it in the weeks and months to come, but he was slated to win the King of the Ring later on this year. We'll talk about what happens there. But speaking of things to talk about, so we get this recap of how Yokozuna is now out of Cornette's camp, and Doc Hendricks is hyping this interview up as the first ever time that Yokozuna is able to talk, and then you learn right away why he needed a mouthpiece for as long as he did. God bless the man. Rest in peace, Yokozuna, but you were not the best promo, sir.
No, some guys just need it.
Yeah.
It's no insult on them, but not everyone can be The Rock.
So we have British Bulldog with Jim Cornette taking on Yokozuna. This match, it's reasonably short. We have some brawling to start off here, but then Jim Cornette, he gets involved rather quickly. Jim Cornette, he leaps into the ring, attacks Yokozuna with a tennis racket, but Yokozuna feels nothing, and it's all set to attack his former manager when Vader shows up at the scene and works with Bulldog to handcuff the rival to the ropes. So the winner via disqualification is Yokozuna at 5 minutes and 5 seconds. This is pretty much just to set up WrestleMania, right?
Yeah, we're setting up a multi-man segment. Or you could have been setting up Vader versus Yokozuna just one-on-one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too, because they turn this into a tag match the next month. And I absolutely agree with you. Why not just make it one-on-one unless Vader... He was still nursing an injury at this time, I think. I think he had just had...
I also don't think they trusted Yoko to have a full match by himself.
So Todd Pettengill, he's back in the scene here. He's talking to Owen Hart as we're documenting. Shawn Michaels kind of riding that wave of, you know, he's the underdog and he's working his way up after getting the crap beat out of him a few months before. He wins the Royal Rumble. And now we have his title match on the line here. And Owen Hart swears that he's going to take this title match away from him. Of course, we know that's not going to happen. So, next up, we have the number one contenders match. We have Owen Hart versus Shawn Michaels. These guys, I wish they had more matches together. You know, they didn't really work too much together. They had some great chemistry. Did you think so, Matt?
Yeah, because I think their styles were just so, you know, because Owen, much more dynamic as a performer than Brett ever could hope to be from a pure athleticism standpoint. And, of course, Shawn could have a five-star match with a broom, as The Undertaker talks about. So it's kind of just disappointing when you look at how things would play out that these two didn't have a full program like Brett did with Owen in 94. Like, you certainly could have done that post-screw job where you never had that Owen-Shawn feud, especially since mm-hmm. Shawn would have been the champion at that point. You could have done that. I mean, part of it's just because Austin was where he was. But yeah, it's a big regret because Shawn has a history of working with everyone in this family. Now, he had a really good series with British Bulldog earlier, so I think these two were capable of having an extended program.
Yeah, for sure. God, I can't wait to get to that when the fallout of Survivor Series, because, man, what an opportunity that was. Oh, what an opportunity you had to really get some great action going on there. But we have this number one contender match. We have some stalling, showboating in the beginning stages here. Michaels definitely, let's be honest, at this point, no wonder McMahon wanted to ride this train, because Michaels, he was always the highlight of each card, wasn't he?
Yeah, although I think for a lot of people it was begrudgingly, and part of it's also by default.
So they brawl on the inside and they fly around the ring and some gripping back and forth action. God, these two were just, they were on their game in the 1990s. I love watching this match. I think they were on their game. Dramatic pause from the nonstop action comes when Owen Hart hits that Enziguri kick. We're building and building and building it up to Owen Hart hitting this Enziguri kick, and here it is. Originally took HBK out of action storyline-wise, and Michaels does sell it. He's wobbling a bit, staggers, falls out of the ring. But rather than take the count out, Owen Hart goes for the pin, only for Michaels to kick out and restart the match. We get a real dramatic closing sequence here, ultimately culminating in sweet chin music and a three count at 15 minutes and 57 seconds. Your winner, Shawn Michaels. Matt, you know, while the suspense of who was going to win was never in doubt, you got to say, this was a pretty good match, wasn't it?
Well, it's the best thing on the show by far. And the crowd popped, so it did its job, even though the finish seemed blatantly obvious if anyone had half a brain. Just great stuff. Like, Owen had the best missile dropkick of anybody in the business. Like, I don't think he ever missed once in his whole career. You know, Shawn's still the only person who, even though his super kick was a finisher, he didn't beat it to death like so many indie wrestlers have done over the past 20 years. He's like the one person where I see that move and don't cringe. So, all in all, this is good stuff. I mean, it would have been nice if they kind of teased maybe the sharpshooter playoff Shawn, you know, maybe he gets caught going for the super kick and gets put in the sharpshooter. But the crowd's really into it too, so mission accomplished on all fronts.
I really, really dug this match. You know, I wasn't sure what I was going to feel coming in, but I knew that these two always worked good matches around this time, and it was just good stuff. And, you know, I'm not just saying that as a Shawn Michaels mark. I'm a self-admitted Shawn Michaels mark. I was a huge fan of the guy around this time, despite the fact that, you know, he was not the best of gentlemen at this time, as we find out later on. But here, I thought these two really, really were on it. Definitely the highlight of the night, for sure. Matt, you know who's not a highlight in 1996?
Well, I can think of a lot of people, but tell me.
Rowdy Piper. So Todd Pettengill introduces Piper. He comes out and he warns Shawn Michaels to bring his A game at WrestleMania. And then he books Vader versus Yokozuna, which, goddamn, I mean, you had it there. They ended up taking that away. And of course, here comes Jim Cornette and Clarence Mason. They kind of rant against Piper here. This is enjoyable interaction between Cornette and Roddy Piper, two old school guys in the wrestling business. And then the long and short of it being that if Vader lost, Yoko might just have the opportunity to get his hands on Jim Cornette. Entertaining segment if it just went on a little too long. I think they were kind of realizing that time was, they needed to kind of fill some time here. And I don't know, this wasn't the best segment. What'd you think?
Well, I get the sense they told Piper, take as long as you need, which is never the smartest decision.
That is a death nail if I ever heard one. Take as long as you need, Piper.
You know, you're setting yourself up to go long, but they were also not really doing anything to lead you to believe Piper was actually going to have a match at WrestleMania, which, great, I know that sort of happened at the last minute. But you watch this show, you think this would have ended with Vader just knocking out Piper or something.
Yeah. Why didn't that happen? All right, so it's time.
They were afraid because, like, it wasn't too soon after that where Vader would beat the shit out of Gorilla Monsoon.
Well, he did it before this.
Oh, that's right.
He did it at the Royal Rumble. Yeah. Oh, right before the Royal Rumble. So here we have our main event of the night. We have a World Wrestling Federation Championship match in the cage between Bret the Hitman Hart and Big Daddy Cool Diesel. Blow off to their feud. They had a pretty entertaining match at the 94 King of the Ring. They had a really good, if drawn out, match at the 1995 Royal Rumble. Both matches I saw live, not in person, but on pay-per-view as they were happening. And we keep getting told that Bret Hart has never lost a cage match. This was not a disappointing match either, I gotta say. It did start off rather slow, sluggish. We're building up the drama here. But, you know, we have Diesel doing his normal stuff. And Diesel, he and Bret, they would kind of get into it when they were in WCW together. But Diesel never really had a bad thing to say about Bret. Kevin Nash has always said some good things, especially about the kind of matches that him and Bret Hart had. What do you think about the opening moments here of this match? Kind of gets a little slow, doesn't it?
But it's also interesting to look at the crowd reaction for Diesel because he's acting more heelish, but he's still getting cheered by a portion of the crowd. Bret obviously got the latter ovation, which was a good thing, but I think they were right, though. Like, that wasn't a kayfabe thing to say Bret's never lost a cage match. I mean, he's only had, what, the one against Owen at SummerSlam?
That's the only one I can think of.
I can't think of any other
head.
Major Bret Hart cage matches.
The finish comes with Diesel getting the upper hand, yet just as he was about to get out of the ring, here comes The Undertaker from beneath the canvas, dragging Diesel to hell, or at least under the ring, giving Bret Hart the perfect opportunity to scale the cage and fall to the floor at 19 minutes and 13 seconds. We're going to talk about the ramifications of this and how this ending came about and what caused Diesel to actually leave the Federation. But for now, let's talk about this match. What do you think of this match?
Definitely not as good as the Survivor Series match. There is a portion where the crowd is kind of dead when he's working him over with the forearms, and it's not terrible. Like, this match is fine, but hurt by the fact that we've seen them do better several times, so it's kind of hurt by that. And the Undertaker thing, it's still a little hokey. I know the Undertaker kind of gets a pass for a lot of it because it's his gimmick, but to see another 7-foot guy drag another 7-foot guy through the ring just looks ridiculous.
It really does. In the build-up to this match, I completely forgot to mention that Survivor Series 95 match, which we covered last year. Yeah, I'm with you, man. I think of all their matches, this isn't their best. It's probably their least entertaining match of their series of matches. Diesel in a cage, you have him and Bret. Bret Hart is obviously the consummate wrestler, and Kevin Nash isn't, you know? And if you have a plodding guy against a big wrestling guy in a cage, what is the purpose of the cage if you're going to do that? The danger of putting Bret into the cage or whatever is there, but the drama is kind of taken away. So let's talk about the ramifications here. So initially, when there was a meeting before this match took place, I'm sure you've heard this story. They were around the round table. It was Kevin Nash, it was Bret Hart, and it was The Undertaker with the booking team in this conference room. They're going over it, and Kevin Nash mentions that I will agree to go into the ring, but I think I should hit my finisher on Bret Hart. I should hit the powerbomb. And Bret Hart is just chiming up with, my fans would not really go with me taking the powerbomb from you because they know that that would mean I was going to lose and it would make me look weak. And they would pitch it and pitch it and pitch it. And Bret Hart would always say the same exact fucking thing. No, it would make me look weak. Finally, of all people, Undertaker slams his hand on the table and just stands up and says, motherfucker, not everything is about you. Kevin Nash was fighting to get his finisher in. He's like, look, I need to hit this finisher. And he didn't know until the day of when Vince McMahon came up to him and said that, yeah, don't hit your finisher on Bret. We're going to have it done Bret's way. That was when Kevin Nash said, you know what? There's my papers. I want to go ahead and join Scott, leave the company. He was all set to stay until that point. But boy, if that doesn't prove that Bret Hart takes his character way too seriously, then I don't know what does.
He acts like he should be booked like Hulk Hogan, where he cannot be beat. He cannot be made to look weak whatsoever. He doesn't have the physique of Hogan or the political ability to pull that off, so it just makes him seem kind of covetous in an ego trip type of way. Because people rip on people like Triple H for being egomaniacs. A lot of it warranted. But Bret Hart doesn't get talked about enough for being too overprotective of his self-image.
It's a shame. And, you know, we'll talk about when he gets to WCW in a couple years, but it's just like, man, like, you wonder why people didn't know how to book you, because you always booked yourself into a corner. And then when you're piping up like this and you're all about your character, my character, my character. Well, guess what? It's fucking wrestling, dude. Just go out and entertain the audience. Don't think about your goddamn character.
And also, what character? Like,
yeah,
Bret Hart was never, not until 1997 did he actually have a full-on persona besides I'm just the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. That was his whole shtick. From, what, 1991 to 97? So he needs to get off his fucking high horse, acting like he had this really... He acts like he's the Undertaker.
Yeah.
And I'm glad the Undertaker, of all people, is the one who says it's not all about you, because if there's someone who knows about taking a bullet for the team, it's that guy. Like, he took enough bullets to look like Swiss cheese by the time he retired.
Says the guy who went up against, you know, Giant Gonzalez and
King Kong Bundy.
Kamala.
And if you remember, Diesel was supposed to beat Undertaker at WrestleMania.
Yes, he was.
So the streak would not have happened if not for Bret Hart going on his ego trip. So I guess we should thank Bret for something.
Here we go. That's In Your House, Rage in the Cage. Short and sweet. You know, I mean, goddamn. We talked about Clash of Champions last week. This is about as long as that particular show. Scale of 1 to 10, what do you give In Your House, Rage in the Cage, sir?
It's tough to judge this show because it's very top-heavy. And I'm someone, when I'm reviewing wrestling, I like to look at shows from the grand scheme if I'm going to give it an overly positive score. Like, I think your show from top to bottom has to be really, really tight and escalate. Like, there's some shows that can have one or two stinker matches if you have a bigger card. But this is only five matches. And one of them is great. The main event's a bit of a letdown, because context is key. Razor and Kid had a good match, but is hamstrung by a stupid gimmick. And then the other two were just, you know, filler nonsense. So I do have to weigh that. But because of how good the Shawn Owen match is, despite, you know, the writing being on the wall and neon paint, I think that there's more to this show that I would recommend versus not. Like, this is not... Compared to In Your House 4 that ended with Vince McMahon, like, tearing off his headset, he was so mad about how it went. This is leaps and bounds better than that. So I'm going to give it a 6.
You know what? That doesn't happen very often, but you and I are on the exact same page on this. I know you hate the phrase, but this is a one-match show, honestly. You could turn on the Owen-Shawn Michaels match and really say, you know what? That was pretty damn entertaining. That was what I pay my hard-earned money to watch wrestling for. And then you have the other matches on this, which, okay, Hunter, Drosy, you know, this is Hunter kind of rising his way out of the ranks. You know, it's kind of entertaining to see how he starts as opposed to how he ends up. His humble beginnings at this point were pretty, it's kind of entertaining for me to see going through it. I gotta say, going through these shows with you. The Diesel Hart match was entertaining enough, but as I mentioned, definitely the lesser of the matches that they had. And the Razor 1-2-3 Kid match was just as it is. It's a gimmick match, something that probably came out of the head of Jim Cornette, and it is the click front and center. So, but still, that being said, I thought it was a pretty entertaining match, all things considered. I thought it was going to be much more painful than what it ended up being. I think the Shawn Michaels Owen Hart match carries this show, and I'm with you. I have a 6 written down as well. Entertaining enough, and it is less painful. I mean, it's less than 2 hours, you know, so you don't have too big of a time commitment here. But honestly, this show's one purpose was to build to the next month's WrestleMania. You can take a hour and 45 minute promo, then that's what you have here. And for what that is, though, I didn't. It wasn't as bad as I was expecting when I turned it on for this particular review. All right, Matt, when we reconvene, we're going to talk Super Brawl. We're going to have two big cage matches. We have Hulk and Giant. We have Savage and Flair. What are you thinking, Matt, when we talk about Super Brawl next time we talk wrestling?
I mostly remember this show for the controversy it created with breaking kayfabe. in a huge segment. And I also remember the big Miss Elizabeth turn, because that was such a shocking thing. Outside of that, not a whole lot. But at least that show has a lot of matches on it, which is more... I think we're going to get a lot more wrestling on that show than we have in a WCW show for a long time.
Yes. Matches that hopefully go longer than 7 minutes. Yeah, I have memories of it. I did order the pay-per-view, because as I mentioned 100 times, I'm a big Hogan mark. Yeah, that was definitely a shocking turn, and I can't wait to talk about it, because, yeah, the breaking kayfabe moment that you mentioned, goddamn. Talk about shocking to me and my friend watching it at the time. We just kind of looked at each other like, whoa. So we'll talk about that next week. But until next week, when we talk Super Brawl 6, we'll see you at the matches. Thank you, Matt.